What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends Podcast. John Krofcik, the indispensable one. How are you, sir?
I don't know about that.
Well, you are.
But I'm doing well.
Good. You look well.
Thank you.
And here we are again with a new episode. How many episodes?
This is a very interesting one, though.
You think so?
Yeah. We got that Navy guy. Come on, tell us about those boats.
Yeah, absolutely. Boats, Navy, water, oceans. But, John, seriously, didn't you bet on sea blindness in the third at Aqueduct? Wasn't that
That's where I've heard that name before.
Yeah. I love that book, Sea Blindness. Oh, it's Sea Biscuit. Remember that? You remember that?
I do.
Yeah, that was a great book, actually.
It was.
I mean, that really was. I forgot the woman who wrote that. I believe we had her on radio years ago. But, well, that was a great story. But we're not talking about a horse that America loved.
That's right. We're talking about boats.
We're talking about
ships,
boats.
Actually. Ships.
Sea blindness, how political neglect is choking American sea power. And, John, we've seen some terrible episodes recently where our guys in the fleet in the Pacific have been blindsided. They seem to have been a little off their game. They seem to have been, not really trained as well as perhaps they might.
I haven't heard anything about that, since it's happened, the two episodes of crashes they've had. Because I'd be curious to know what really caused those incidents out there.
Well, I think there's a lot going on that we're not aware of because we are a sea power across the world. I don't think people think about this, but when you think about the number of carriers that we have and these carrier fleets and how much we launch from these boats or these carriers, I mean, if America didn't have a presence around the world, a lot of people wonder whether the world would be a whole lot more unstable than it is even today.
That's true. That's true. But it just, why all of a sudden within a 3-month period we have two big accidents? I mean, these boats with all the technology and everything, how does that happen?
I know. I think we're all a bit confused. And I hope that Seth Cropsey, who was a major figure within the U.S. Navy over the years, can help explain that to us. We do ask him about that. But he is also here to explain to us the notion of what is sea blindness. And it is an old term, and it describes a maritime nation's forgetfulness of the ocean's role in prosperity and security. And I point out, I believe in the interview, that when you look at the Atlantic and the Pacific and how much they have been our friends over the years, you wouldn't imagine that America could forget how fortunate we have been that we are, flanked by these oceans and how much we have used that as a natural part of our defense.
No, you're right. With, the shipping and all that goes on, I mean, you'd think you're absolutely right. We wouldn't forget that. But I don't know. Then you got technology comes into play a lot of times, and we got satellites now. So, and we got all different technology. So maybe our Navy's being forgotten a little bit because they think, well, we got this other technology that's better.
Ah, that's an interesting point. I mean, look at the British Empire was built on their naval strength, and the Spanish Armada, and all of these over the centuries. But you think about it. I mean, if you were to categorize the most important of all the elements of our defense, would it be the Army, the Marines, the Air Force? Now, the Air Force came into real vogue in World War II.
Right.
What would you say?
Well, looking at it, I would think you're absolutely right, the Navy, because they can deliver. They can deliver aircraft. They can deliver manpower. They can deliver stuff to almost anywhere in the world in a short amount of time. I mean, you think about it, what they can do.
Do you realize how far-flung the U.S. is in terms of the use of its Navy all across the world? I mean, some of us might be surprised when we hear, well, the U.S. fleet in the Mediterranean or the Gulf of this or that. I mean, we are just everywhere. But are we really supporting the Navy in the way that we have put them out there? Are we really giving them the resources that they need? Or is there a bit of sea blindness going on in our culture today?
Well, I think there is, but I think also we have a problem because because our Navy is so big, we're the peacemakers around the world, and I don't know how we kind of separate ourselves a little bit from that to give our Navy a break. I mean,
would you believe this? If I did say to you, I mean, tell me true or false, honestly, on this. American sea power has not been as small as it is today since before World War I.
Wow.
Would you believe that?
That's kind of scary. No, I wouldn't believe that.
I mean, with all the obligations we placed on them.
Right.
And where we have them positioned around the world to keep a lot of treaty obligations, not only to ourselves, but to so many allies around the world, the free world. That's a little daunting to think that we're not keeping up in that way.
That's kind of scary, especially, you know, you got these pirates out there that are constantly, you know, impeding the trade routes in some areas.
Well, don't forget also, we've got a conventional fleet, and then we've got the nuclear fleet. I know that one of the pieces that was on 60 Minutes recently about the Arctic and whether, in fact, the Russians are up there with a lot of intent using their Navy and whether our Navy is capable of responding to some of their aggression up in the Arctic. Well, we're going to learn about all of these things today, and it's not a topic that a lot of people talk about, but there is this new book called Sea Blindness, How Political Neglect is Choking American Sea Power, and Seth Cropsey is the gentleman who wrote it. He served as Deputy Undersecretary of the U.S. Navy in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. So we really want to talk to him about all of this today.
Yeah, no, it's going to be very interesting.
All right, let's take it. Let's go to sea.
With us, of course, is Seth Cropsey. And Mr. Cropsey, I've got to ask you, you've written this book called Sea Blindness, How Political Neglect is Choking American Sea Power and What to Do About It. Sea blindness, for those of us who have never heard that term, what does it mean?
It means it's a reference to a maritime state's inability to understand or its ability to forget that its security and economy depends upon free navigation on the high seas.
And America, put us into some context. I think many of us think of the British Empire and the importance of their naval fleet. What about America? It would seem that even if we think of ourselves as having great air power, that when you look at the Atlantic and the Pacific that abut us, that we must really hold a lot of importance in our naval strength.
The problem in the United States has been that the Navy and the sea services, which is to say Navy and Marines and the Coast Guard, have been so successful during World War II and afterwards that we've tended to take them for granted. And as attention has focused on the land wars that the nation has been involved in since Desert Storm, we've taken them even more for granted. So that means that they've been underfunded, as have other military services. And we simply assume that a decreasing fleet, which ours has been since the end of the Cold War, can handle all the increasing requirements that have accumulated since the end of the Cold War.
Could you help us understand how far a field we have gone in terms of our naval strength? A lot of us reading about the 7th Fleet recently and some of the problems that we've seen. But where are we across the globe as it relates to the U.S. Navy? What are the responsibilities of the Navy today?
Well, the Navy has responsibilities around the globe. That's why it's called a why we call it a transoceanic global Navy. We're unlike any other country in that sense. We have vital security interests around the globe. The Navy is operating today off the shores of both American coasts. It's operating in the Caribbean. It's operating in the Eastern Mediterranean and participating in the fight against ISIS. We have NATO forces that have to be on guard against increased Russian presence in the Baltic and Black Seas. We have naval forces that have to protect choke points around the world, like the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which leads from the Red Sea into the Gulf of Aden, and then a few hundred miles to the east, the Strait of Hormuz, and in the Arabian Gulf itself, where so much oil flows, is exported to the United States and to the rest of the world, and also in places like the straits that connect the Indian Ocean with the West Pacific. So, and that doesn't even begin to look at the strategic deterrence, which is to say the submarines that we have to carry nuclear weapons as a deterrent against nuclear attack. So we're operating all over the world to protect our interests, to keep our people safe by preventing crises elsewhere from escalating and reaching our own borders, and by protecting our allies who are essential to our defense.
I would imagine that our treaty obligations require us to be far-flung around the world, protecting their interests and ours. And I know that this administration has talked about America first, but realistically, what are the expectations today that our Navy has to carry out?
Well, you're right. We have treaty obligations to five countries in Asia. We have treaty obligations to NATO. We have common sense obligations in keeping open the supply routes that provide the United States and its allies with oil. We really do have vital interests around the world. There are no treaty obligations involved in the campaign against ISIS, but I think most Americans agree that it's in our country's vital strategic interest to destroy them.
In your book, Sea Blindness, you suggest that we in the United States are losing the understanding that sea power is essential for protecting our commerce. What is it that we think is going to take the place of our sea power and its might and its presence around the world?
Well, if the United States falters and we allow our sea power further to decline, there's one nation that would very happily take our place and impose its own idea of order, and that's China. China, after Mao died, had a very small coastal force that was capable of doing very little except guarding fisheries and protecting the immediate coastline. Today they have two aircraft carriers and are building a third. They have nuclear submarines equipped with ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. They have other submarines, attack submarines. They're building a large surface fleet. They have their effort is strategy is to be able to deny large portions of the West Pacific to the American Navy, and so the most likely replacement for the benign presence, use of American force around the world at sea would be China.
Should we look upon some of the things that we've read recently about what's been going on with the Seventh Fleet as kind of a harbinger of the things that you're talking about in terms of underutilization, under-resourced, perhaps lack of training? This is what I read in the Wall Street Journal. Should we be concerned that this gives us a sense of some of the problems that you see developing within our naval force?
Well, I think we should be very concerned. Navy has yet to complete both investigations, or at least make them public. But so far, the Navy has said about the first collision that took place in June in the entrance to Tokyo Bay that the bridge crew did not have sufficient situational awareness, which means it's sort of Navy speak for they weren't entirely aware of what was going on around them. And I think that points to training deficiencies, and that's understandable, not good, and not excusable, but as the Navy has shrunk, and at the end of the Cold War, the Navy had about almost 600 ships, and the fleet today has 276 ships, while its requirements have been increasing. But as the Navy has responded to more demands with a shrinking force, it's simply kept ships at sea longer. Longer deployments, and longer deployments mean more maintenance and when a ship returns home, and more maintenance means that other things suffer while the ship is repaired so that it can be deployed again. And the question that we're waiting to see how the Navy answers is whether those increased requirements and increased maintenance are having an effect on training, and I believe they are.
This fleet decline from 600 to 276, this has to have been going on under many administrations, many naval secretaries. How can we allow that to continue, given our responsibilities around the globe?
Well, I don't think we can, but in the end, it's not so much a question of Navy secretaries or the Defense Department. It's really a question of what the American people want and what they know and what they expect of their representatives in Congress. And so the ultimate question is, will Americans take notice of what's happened? Will they realize how far the Navy has shrunk? Do they understand how much requirements have increased? And if all of those questions are answered in the positive, are they willing to make the sacrifice? And it is a sacrifice because it's cost money in order to revitalize the fleet and modernize it and build a large enough fleet so that it can handle what's expected of it by repeated American presidents.
Explain to us what is going on vis-a-vis the conventional fleet versus the nuclear fleet. We are now emanating from Connecticut, and there is a lot of shipbuilding that is going on at Electric Boat, and they have gotten a commitment for, I believe, 2 nuclear subs a year, and lots of people are being employed. Is there a difference in terms of the resources being allocated to the nuclear fleet versus the conventional fleet?
Well, the biggest problem facing the submarine community today, the single biggest problem is that ballistic missile-carrying submarines, the Ohio class, is aging very quickly. Those boats the building of those boats took place during and slightly before the Reagan administration. And those boats are reaching the end of their useful service lives, and a replacement is going to have to be found. And the Navy's drawing up plans for that right now, but they're very expensive, as much as $5 or $6 billion a boat, and who knows, maybe more. So even though that's an absolute necessity for the nation's defenses and for a second strike capability, which would deter another nation from thinking that it could get away with a first strike, somebody's got to pay for it. If that payment for those submarines comes out of the regular Navy shipbuilding budget, it will have extraordinary effects, and it will reduce the Navy's ability to buy regular conventional nuclear-powered attack submarines, right? At the same time that it reduces the Navy's ability to buy surface ships, aircraft carriers, all the other ships that are necessary to maintain a global transoceanic fleet.
The aircraft carriers that you're talking about, I forgot the number that we have. Is it 7 or 8? And the
it's
Chinese,
11.
How many?
11.
11. And the Chinese have 1 or 2. Is that correct?
They have 2 and are building a third.
All right. How important are those aircraft carriers? They seem to be really a symbol of America's dominance on the seas.
Well, they are both a symbol of our global dominance of the seas, and they also allow it in large measure. The aircraft carrier is as flexible a tool as the planes that fly from its decks. And those planes can project power, which is to say bomb and strafe targets on land. They can defend the ship and against other planes and missiles. They can hunt for submarines. They can also hunt for ships. They can be used against surface ships. They're extremely important, not only as a symbol, but as a fact of American sea power.
And are we maintaining those well enough? Are we looking at the next class of aircraft carriers? I mean, how significant a sign is that, that America wants to resource its Navy in the ways necessary?
Well, the Trump administration is asking to build another carrier, a 12 carrier, and I think that's a sensible request. Just because we have 11 or 12, if we do, 12 carriers, doesn't mean that they can all be deployed at once. Ships go out for, one hopes, no more than 6 months, although now it's usually considerably longer than that. And ships require intermediate maintenance. They require refueling at a certain point in their life cycles. And crews have to be trained. And ships that are returning, the sailors need time off. So 11 carriers doesn't, in fact, mean, or 11 or 12 if we get an additional one, doesn't mean, in fact, that we have 11 or 12 carriers deployed around the world. It means more like something like four. The numbers are deceptive.
You were the Deputy Undersecretary of the U.S. Navy in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. So I don't know if it's fair to ask you this, but I will. Navy, Army, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, what is foundational? Would you say the Navy, given its importance and its agility around the world and the signal that it sends about U.S. presence, is that foundational in your mind to the whole tapestry of our military?
Well, I'm not sure I would use the word foundational, but I would say, I do say that the Navy is performs a strategic mission that the other services, where the other services have different strengths. The Navy's strategic mission is to keep crises from escalating and reaching our borders. It includes providing humanitarian assistance that the Army and the Air Force, where the Army and the Air Force doesn't often do that because they don't have big pieces of equipment that can carry water and supplies. And providing a presence around the world, is a visible presence of powerful ships, is very important to deterrence. It reassures our allies. It lets our potential adversaries know that we are either within sight or just over the horizon and able to project power. And in that sense, America's vital interests are protected in a way by sea power that they are not by air power and ground forces.
In the book, Sea Blindness, you strikingly provide these scenarios in which various rival powers like China, you mentioned them, Iran, North Korea, and Russia could take advantage of some of the depletion of our naval supremacy. And I was just viewing a 60 Minutes piece on the Arctic and what's going on up there in terms of the Russian influence that their Navy is trying to inflict on that region. And is that a case in point as to where the United States and Russia, for example, in the area of naval supremacy could meet a flashpoint?
Certainly is. Nobody knows with certainty what kind of resources are below the seabed in the Arctic. There are all sorts of speculations of valuable minerals from oil to gold and rare metals. So until that's discovered, and it will be, the question of navigational routes, where mining is allowed by which country remains very much up in the air. And soft power is fine and by way of persuasion, but hard power will be essential in staking claims there. So if you don't have the ships to compete, and if you're not able to protect those ships, especially the research vessels and American companies that want to explore and see what can be extracted from that part of the world, then you're not in the game.
Well, you talk about various threats, China's actions in the South China Sea, the Russian Navy's return to the Black Sea, the threat to NATO member states along the Baltic, and then, of course, Iran's threats to various shipping interests within the Straits of Hormuz. If we were to look at areas that you are most concerned about, unless we begin to pay greater attention to the importance of our Navy and making certain that it has the resources it needs, what area, where would we perhaps first see some of these threats emerging to the greatest degree?
China. China has an active, ongoing campaign of many years to turn the waters, the international waters of the South China Sea and the East China Sea into essentially territorial waters of China, or at least waters over which China has influence and can decide who comes and goes within those waters. And that is antithetical to American foreign policy going back to Thomas Jefferson, who understood when the Barbary pirates threatened American shipping in the Mediterranean that the United States, as a commercial power that relied on the seas, couldn't allow that to happen. If we allow China to start cutting off large pieces of international waters and claiming them as sovereign territory, the effects will not only be to our commerce in the West Pacific, the effects will be all over the world in the general understanding called a world order, that there are limits to a nation's territorial control, and beyond that, there's the international commons, which are open to free passage of vessels from all countries of the world.
In closing, in your book, you suggest that our sea power has to change its focus from attacking land targets to commanding the seas nearest to a potential adversary. Put that into some context where our listeners can understand a case in point.
In both Desert Storm and the Second Gulf War, planes from American carriers were used to attack Iraqi land installations, communications, bridges, military targets themselves, command and control centers. But a lot of countries that are potential adversaries, like China and Russia, took the lessons of our involvement in wars in Iraq to heart. And they realized that if they could keep the U.S. Navy from approaching their shores closely enough, they could avoid a fate like Saddam Hussein suffered. So when the Chinese are building surface ships and submarines and aircraft carriers, and the Russians are modernizing their naval force, Their expectation is that they'll be able to keep us at a distance. And that means that our focus has to shift from projecting power to making sure that those navies are not the predominant ones in those parts of the world. And that means shifting from projecting power to another traditional naval mission, which is sea control.
Is there anything else that you'd like our listeners to think about as they hear the debate about defense spending going forward and the role of the Navy? Is there anything else that you think they should understand?
I think the most important thing to understand is that if they read this book, or even if they simply listen to this interview, that the most they can do, the the important role they can play is to write their congressman and to ask questions and insist that this subject get more attention than it has, and underline the importance of the Navy to this nation's security, both now and in the future.
I know there's going to be perhaps another look at a BRAC commission in terms of closing bases. Does that have any impact on our seaworthiness when they hear that debate going on?
Well, it depends upon which bases are closed. I don't think that anybody is proposing that we close our naval base in San Diego or in Norfolk, Virginia. But if there are bases where there are bases that are not being used except as sources of employment in a particular congressman's district, saving the money from closing that base would provide money for essential things in the military. So I would look at the BRAC recommendations very carefully. A lot of the bases, or at least several of the bases that we have, are no longer necessary, and the first BRAC, the first attempt at the base reduction initiative was successful in providing resources. It's not the answer, but it's a sensible way to look for money.
Thank you so much for being with us today on AmericaTrendsPodcast.com. You've been listening to the former Deputy Undersecretary of the U.S. Navy, Seth Cropsey, and the book is called Sea Blindness, How Political Neglect is Choking American Sea Power and What to Do About It. Thank you once again.
Thank you, Larry.
If you like this episode, please leave us a kind rating or review. I'm on my hands and knees. Please do it on iTunes, because your review is really critical for us to continue providing this podcast. And John, I know that iTunes looks at this. They want to make certain that we have some ranking, some visibility, and that we're getting some traffic, and then they give you better positioning.
Absolutely. And this way, it'll put us in the forefront so you can find us much easier on your iPhone or Android, whatever you may be using.
And they may even send you out an alert. So please, if you can, don't miss a single episode of America Trends Podcast. And, John, they can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com.
And also subscribe on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
We send out a little blurb, and we can also take your emails there at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. That's another way to get us.
And we do not sell or share
no
our
spamming,
lists.
Nothing.
Well, I don't know. Does anybody want our lists? I don't know, but we don't do it.
Good question.
Even if they asked us.
Even
nobody's
if they
asked us.
But. Right.
And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We're getting very active on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms, and John, this is really easy, @TrendsPodcast. That's it.
That's real easy.
You like that? Did you get that?
I got that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check it out now. I'm going to have to tweet it.
We want to thank you, of course, personally for subscribing. And we also would like to get some of your ideas and questions for future episodes of America Trends Podcast. And that's important, too, because we're all over the map. Our interest editorially in the future, John, has no bounds. But we want to know what it is that you'd like to hear from us, if there was a segment that you'd like to see us follow up on, or if there's something in depth that you'd like us to deal with. Please let us know that, too.
We're looking at the future. There's so much we can look at.
Yeah, and the topics that we've dealt with, I mean, we have gotten such incredible guests over the recent period, but they're only going to come to us if they know we've got an engaged and interactive audience.
Absolutely.
So it's really important that you become part of this podcast in so many different ways that we're sharing with you today.
You're absolutely right. We need your support and your help and your reviews.
And your ideas.
And ideas.
Or questions on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us @TrendsPodcast or using the #TrendsPodcast. You can also add an email address if you have a public one that you'd like us to give out.
Yeah, good. And you know what? We didn't mention Amazon.
Oh, yes. We have an Amazon store.
Yes.
And so if you go up, you don't have to buy the things that might be highlighted at that particular time. You can buy any book, and there's some benefit that comes back
just
to us.
Just put what you're looking at in the little search engine block there, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and it'll help us out?
Absolutely. And it doesn't really cost you anything more because they have built that into their pricing structure. So we get a little taste and you get more programming like this and you get the item that you were looking for. So it works for all of us.
It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
So for more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. And again, you can find John and I here in our studio performing as best we can for you.
That's right. Let us out.
What's that?
Let us out.
Let us out. No one is. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. We'll see you next time.
We hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, by the way, we are posting all the time, and we're posting on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Good point.
So just be aware, if you're looking for new episodes, they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you wake up, before you go out on your jog or your walk and you want to take us with you, we'll be there for you.
Very good.
All right. Have a great day.